Chapter 14. Unrequited Love. It was August 1966, and the prospect of taking a break from art school study to return to the New Guinea Highlands always filled me with great excitement and expectancy. This time Kundiawa was my destination. The Kundiawa community comprised our hosts, the Simbu people, and a diverse collection of expatriates, mostly Europeans, often misfits, who had found a niche in this country that was often referred to as the last frontier. It was an unpredictable place, where incidents, both amusing and not so, often came out of left field. A few days into my holiday, family friend Richard Carlson arrived back in Kundiawa with a freshly minted New Zealand commercial pilot's license, the result of an expensive 12 months of intensive study. He returned to New Guinea for two reasons. Firstly, to get a job flying small aircraft that were, and continue to be, the lifeblood of the Highlands. And secondly, to propose marriage to his former girlfriend. By way of background, before leaving Kundiawa for New Zealand, Richard was in a relationship with the talented Wendy Gore. Wendy was one of two young English women who had been offered the opportunity to travel overland from the United Kingdom to the New Guinea Highlands with Dick Kellart, the licensee of the Kundiawa Hotel. Dick had purchased a brand new Land Rover in London and planned to get it home the long way. In return for their amazing travel adventure, the women agreed to work at Dick's hotel, affectionately known as the Kundiawa Hilton, for 2 years with accommodation provided, in addition to wages. Wendy, a cordon bleu cook, managed the kitchen, and Annabelle Donald worked front of house and the bar. Dick had struck gold. The women were a magnet for the mostly male drinkers who flocked to the hotel, craving the company of the good-looking, 20-something, English-speaking women, as European women were in short supply throughout New Guinea. Richard was one of the lucky ones. Young and virile, with dreams of becoming a Qantas pilot, he was an attractive prospect. Wendy, who had her choice of suitors, chose him. To make money, Richard worked long days on the road, buying coffee for the Kundiawa Coffee Society. He was saving like crazy to pay the hefty course fees necessary to obtain a commercial pilot's license. When he'd saved enough cash, he planned to head off to New Zealand, where he knew he could obtain the cheapest, accredited qualification. Richard was an expansive young man, who, emboldened with the rashness of youth, on more than one occasion voiced his belief that when he got to New Zealand, he would be knocked down in the rush of beautiful young women, keen to cohabit. He fancied they would be willing to provide everything he needed, regular sex, and a quiet supportive domestic environment, necessary to balance his intense focus on aviation study. Richard packed his dreams and his possessions, farewelled Wendy, and headed east to embark on his next big adventure. But, as is often the case, his fantasy-fueled plans came to naught. Once he'd settled in, and the anticipated flood of eager, attractive young women didn't materialize, he invited Wendy to join him. With Dick Kellart's blessing, she left the Kundiawa Hilton and headed for New Zealand. Why the arrangement was unsuccessful is not known, but after 3 months Wendy returned to Kundiawa and her job at the hotel. Naturally, the publican was thrilled. And everyone else too, as we all loved her and the fabulous gastronomic delights she managed to conjure, often from limited ingredients. Time passed. Some 10 months later, Richard returned to Kundiawa, having obtained his commercial pilot's license. He brought with him an engagement ring for Wendy. As it was difficult to find a private space to propose marriage in Kundiawa, my mother offered our first floor flat for their evening rendezvous. My mother and I then adjourned to the Hilton, where we anxiously awaited the outcome of the proposal. In the interim, unbeknownst to Richard, Wendy had taken up with another young man, and as a result, she wasn't at all interested in rekindling her relationship with him. So, when Richard presented his proposal, along with the ring, Wendy took it, and then, on the spur of the moment, tossed it out through the open glass doors over the balcony and into the darkness. As a result, there could be no doubt in Richard's mind that Wendy's answer was a definite no. Notwithstanding, Richard quickly assembled a group of locals, gave them torches and instructions to carefully search the area below the balcony. The search was unsuccessful. Searching resumed at first light, but once again, turned up nothing. Rejected, Richard left town, broken-hearted, and with his pride in tatters, and, to my knowledge, the ring was never found. But, even before the Richard and Wendy drama, I was having boy-girl challenges of a different kind. As a result of the gender imbalance throughout Papua and New Guinea, and even more so in the Highlands, as a young single woman, I assumed any number of young men would be interested in spending time with me. But no one stepped forward. Why not? I was smart, attractive, and very stylishly dressed. So what was wrong with me? Some years later, I discovered why. My mother had put the fear of God into all the young men living in and around Kundiawa by threatening to cut off an important part of their anatomy if they dared lay a finger on me. Irrespective, one brave fellow stepped forward. He was a recently graduated agricultural officer, keen to help the Highland farmers by introducing some of the techniques he had gained at agricultural college in Australia. One afternoon, he invited me to drive out to visit a group of Simbu farmers, living on a ridge outside the Kundiawa township. I don't know how well his advice was received, but I do know that the Simbus had been successfully growing crops in this very high rainfall mountainous terrain for hundreds and maybe thousands of years. To this day, I wonder how he hoped to improve their cropping methods. Possibly with the introduction of fertilizer? At this time, these people were subsistence farmers with limited purchasing power, making fertilizer a distant dream. Sadly, the friendship petered out, and knowing what I know now, it's highly likely that my mother chased him off. The next exciting event was the arrival of the Canadian Rhinoware salesman. He was offering the Canadian-made, groundbreaking, waterless, stainless steel saucepan sets to a captive market. He knew he was about to make a killing, because most of the Europeans living in the New Guinea Highlands at that time had very little to spend their money on. The enterprising Mr. Rhinoware began his sales trip in Mount Hagen, and then followed the Highlands Highway down through to Lae. He visited every single isolated community he could access, on his way to the coast, enticing many cashed-up expatriates to purchase his superior saucepans. Like the others, my mother was enthralled by his spiel and splashed out. She was thrilled with her purchase. The shiny, 18-piece Rhinoware set replaced the random collection of battered old saucepans in our kitchen, with one exception. The newly purchased revolutionary, non-stick Teflon-coated frying pan. My mother had recently purchased the frying pan in Sydney and brought it back to Kundiawa in her suitcase. Along with the Rhinoware, it had pride of place in our kitchen. But, before long, and to my mother's utter amazement, the internal surface of the frying pan had been transformed from dull black to shiny silver, and now matched the Rhinoware saucepans. How? Our diligent houseboy had taken it upon himself to remove the black non-stick coating. He scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed, believing he was removing cooked-on food. This was completely understandable because our houseboy didn't cook for us. He'd never before seen anything with a Teflon coating. At the time, my mother was gutted, but her displeasure didn't last long. She simply took it in her stride, because incidents of this kind were part and parcel of living in New Guinea. On a more somber note, just before I left to return to Sydney, the Kundiawa community received some very bad news. Simbu province was devastated to hear that Naku, big man, Kondo Magwondo, had been killed in a vehicle accident on the unsealed Highlands Highway. He was being driven up the notoriously dangerous Dalo Pass, situated between Goroka and Kundiawa, on his way home to his family at Wandi. It was pouring with rain and the vehicle slid off the road and into a deep ravine. The Kundiawa community was deeply affected by Kondom's death, as was all of Simbu province, because his positive influence extended far beyond his immediate locality. For some days we noticed a degree of tension in the township. Some were concerned that his death may result in social unrest. Fortunately, nothing untoward transpired to disturb the peace and tranquility of life in Simbu province at that time. For me, all too soon, another memorable holiday in the wilds of the New Guinea Highlands came to an end. Once again I was sad to be leaving the separate reality of Kundiawa, but art school was calling, and as always, I answered the call. On reflection. Richard Carlson. Richard was deeply affected by the unexpected rejection of his marriage proposal, and its repercussions. We remained friends for years afterwards, and spent time together in Sydney, and later in Mexico when he was flying into Mexico City for Qantas. I watched from the sidelines as he played the field, and after some years, he married Wendy Gall. In return for a life-changing overland trip from London to Kundiawa, Wendy fulfilled her two-year commitment to publican Dick Callart, after which she flew back to London to marry a banker, some years her senior. For 3 years, during the 1980s, their elegant, terraced house at Victoria Park became my London base of operations whilst I was living in the north of Scotland at the Findorn Foundation. During Wendy's long widowhood, she served her community as chairperson of the successful Save Barts Hospital campaign begun in 1993, for which she was awarded an OBE. Rena Ware Saucepans. I was very surprised when my mother offered me her precious Rena Ware saucepan set to add to my non-existent hope chest. At the time, I considered the gift a bit of a joke. However, I feel she was ever hopeful I'd find a good bloke and settle down. Over the years I received a number of marriage proposals, and to this day, I wonder if it was me or the saucepans that piqued their interest? Who knows? Some 50 plus years on I continue to use the saucepans daily, and they are fabulous still. Australia and New Guinea. As I travelled between Australia and New Guinea, I didn't realise that I was caught between two worlds. When we first moved to New Guinea, we lived in the small expatriate community of Rabaul, located on the eastern tip of New Britain, surrounded by the Tolai people. I was fascinated by the Tolai, their culture, and their languages. These resilient people had successfully withstood various waves of colonizers. In chronological order, the Germans before World War I, the Australians after World War I, the Japanese in World War II, and, lastly, at the end of the war, Australia took over once again. For 30 more years, Australia governed Papua New Guinea, granting the people independence in 1975. In 1960s Rabaul, we only mixed with other Europeans. Very occasionally, I had the opportunity to connect with the locals, and when I did so, I loved it. These interactions marked the beginnings of my life as a culture junkie, a state of being that prevails to this day. Facts. Rena Ware saucepans. In 1941, Rena Ware began production in Canada. The saucepan range has been redesigned a number of times since my mother's purchase in the mid-1960s. Dowlow Pass is situated halfway between Goroka and Kundiawa, at 2,478 metres above sea level. Dowlow Pass marks the highest point on the Highlands Highway. Kondom Agwondo. Agwondo contested the Highlands Legislative Council seat in the 1961 elections and won. He was a staunch advocate for Highland development. A documentary, Kondom Agwondo, M.L.C., was made in 1962. In the first elections with universal suffrage in 1964, he contested the Simbu seat, but finished third, losing to YECNA. He continued as a member of the Eastern Highlands District Advisory Council, and became chairman of the Kundiawa Coffee Society, the largest cooperative society in Papua New Guinea at that time. Agwondo is known to have had at least 14 wives. and was buried at his village at Wandi, 5 kilometers northwest of Kundiawa. The Simbu Province Headquarters building, as well as the high school near his grave, are named in his honor. The Highlands Highway. Now known as the Okuk Highway, it is the lifeblood of the New Guinea Highlands. It is 700 kilometers long, and runs from Lae, in the Huon Gulf, to Mount Hagen, and, after our time, was extended to provide access to the Porgera gold mine.